We're excited to announce that our very own podcasting platform, Zencastr, has become a new sponsor to the show. Check out the podcast discount link in our show notes and stay tuned for why we love using Zen for the podcast.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to The Archaeology Show with Chris Webster on KNVC 95.1 FM, Carson Community Media, in Carson City, Nevada, and online at knvc.org/listen-live. Welcome to the show. Hello, fans of archaeology, and those that just found this station or page accidentally, especially if you're in Carson City right now with this crazy bike thing that I didn't know was going on. All of Carson City is closed, like downtown, and it's all booths with bicycles, which I'm going to check out after the show because I had no idea that was going on. So that's,
me either.
I know. That's pretty amazing.
I would have brought a bunch of candles. Soap.
Candles and soap. Yeah. No, you're not listening to a show about Fight Club. You're
yet.
Here. Yet. And of course, anybody who has listened to this show for the last month can probably recognize the voice of Brian Woods, my
Hello.
Co-host.
Good morning.
Yeah, right? Okay, so by accident, I decided that we are going to have a show at the end of every month that basically focuses on news items. We've done it just because we didn't have a guest or there was some interesting things in the news, but I think it's just going to kind of work out that way. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, there's never a lot of, you know, really good news throughout the week. I mean, I could pore over journals and things like that, but who has that kind of time?
Right.
So I do searches and stuff like that, and I find things that people are writing about. Because generally, if the media has found it, then you know, it's going to be something interesting to this audience, mm-hmm. right? So, I mean, there's plenty of interesting stuff that's published all the time in journals and things like that. But it's probably only interesting to a very small subset of the population, to
well,
be honest.
I would say that one of your stories is going to broaden that audience considerably.
Indeed. Indeed. Well, we will get to that because it is our first story. And I'm going to turn these mics down just a little bit. They're running a little hot today. So, okay, so in the meantime, while you're listening, remember that this is first and foremost a call-in show. Call in with your questions to 775-515-4141. That's 775-515-4141. You can also tweet your questions to @ArchaeoWebby, @ArchaeoWebby, or @ArchPodNet, @ArchPodNet. And yeah, so call in. I don't know what else I was going to say there. All right, so let's get right to some of our news articles. Like I said, we've got a lot of interesting things. And the first one here, I actually saw a shortened version of this article, and it was called Chinese Stoners, which is what I called it in our notes here for the, today's show. But it's an article from the journal Science Advances, and it's reported on by Joel Achenbach of the Washington Post on June 12th, 2019. And if you ever want to find the references for these, it might take a little while because I release these on the Archaeology Podcast Network, and I do have those in the show notes. So keep searching the Archaeology Podcast Network for these episodes, and you'll eventually find them. Again, this one's probably a couple months out, to be honest. Although, since we're making it the June news show, I might slip it in as like a bonus episode next week or something if I get it done. Anyway, Chinese stoners. The article is actually titled "Archaeologists Find Signs of Ritualized Cannabis Use 2,500 Years Ago in China."
Might I just say that they missed an incredible opportunity, as we'll find out when we talk about this, that they should have titled this Chinese Potheads.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Right. Why? Because?
Yeah. Well, but kind of, but not really, though, because the little graphic here is that they've got on the article, it looks like, honestly, it looks ceramic, but it's actually wooden. So I guess it looks like a wooden pot, but really it's a piece of wood with a hole in it.
No, I'm talking about the person's head that was buried with 2 pounds of weed.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
That's a pot head, man.
Yeah, 2 pounds of weed. So he could use that in the afterlife.
Right. Okay. So
yeah.
Thank you. I've been thinking about this, and as the every person on the show, as the resident artist and pawhead on the show, I want to say we've mentioned this in other articles where I think archaeologists or people that publish articles and they put their spin on things and they try to make everything ritual.
Oh yeah.
When really, this dude probably just really loved weed, right? Ooh, so he could smoke weed. How about that's just what he was known for? And they buried him with what he loved the most.
That's right.
We found ritualized marijuana use at mm-hmm. the gravesite because, you know, that can help them commune. How about going to a funeral is super depressing and weed helps you not be depressed.
Right.
Okay, why does it have to be some, they all prayed first and then they smoked? No, they didn't. Maybe.
Maybe
it's just, you know, this is sad and this will help us not be sad. Like, not everything is related. Most things aren't.
Yeah.
And every article wants to make it that way. And I'm like, just, you know, the person that wrote it isn't a pothead.
Right.
Whoever wrote that article. Because if I would have wrote it, I'd be like, duh, of course.
Right.
It's sad. They took it up there. They smoked. They told stories about the guy. They laughed. And then they came back down the mountain.
Yeah. It seems like anything that's too far back, where we have this really solid separation in time and mm-hmm. space from us and them. And by us, I just mean people in the present, right. No matter where you're at. It seems like anytime there's a significant enough gap, things that we don't specifically know what they used for, we don't. So archaeologists try not to impart their modern bias too. Mm. You know, recreational marijuana use is all over the place right now. It's being legalized in more than half the states in the country, and the rest of them are coming online soon, right? Mm-hmm. So that's the lens that we're kind of looking through this right now, or at least people reading this news article are looking through this right now. But archaeologists really hesitate to do that because 2,500 years ago, who the heck knows what was going on?
Right.
But you're also totally right. And, you know, we can't specifically say it was ritual. We can't. I mean, unless there are certain things, like when you're looking at the design of things, mm-hmm. how they were buried. A lot of times when people are buried with things, like let's say, and this speaks more to your point, you know, this guy is buried, this Chinese man is buried with 2 pounds. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't even know how much volume that is, but 2 pounds.
Spell like this.
Yeah, okay.
There you go. Spell like this.
2 pounds of marijuana, and they say, oh, you know, so he could use it in the afterlife and ritualistic and stuff like that. But other people are buried with swords, sewing needles, you know, I mean, all kinds of stuff.
What about today's people? I hate to say it, but you've seen videos of people getting buried with like 40s.
Right.
And I don't mean weapons. I mean 40s of like booze, right? And just gold or what? Is it to get him to the afterlife? No, because the dude was a G.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like,
right. It's not going to use that in the afterlife. Yeah.
Why did he have a sword with him? Well, because he had it with him every single day.
It
was part of him.
Yeah. You know. The big question I want to know is when does it flip? So if everybody's using marijuana and other plants, to be honest, ritualistically, mm-hmm. X number of years ago, mm-hmm. when does that become recreational for someone? I mean, it was probably recreational for someone, like you said, at all times.
Yeah, right. There was that one dude who's like, oh, look at these posers. They only smoke once when someone dies, right?
Right.
Right. Yeah, of course. Or just like cave paintings. Oh, they really love deer. Maybe that was the worst artist in the tribe, and he was just scratching stuff in there. You don't know.
They stuck him in a cave where no one would see it.
Right. Yeah. We trained him wrong on purpose as a joke.
Yeah, the bad artists always got put in the caves because it was dark in there. No one's going to see your stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. That's such an interesting...
All the good stuff got eroded because it was out in view where people could see
That's
it.
That's right. That's right. Nice, nice. Well, you might be wondering, to get back to the science of this a little bit, they found this because they were able to do a chemical analysis on the residues found at the burial site. And because they didn't find like actual weed. I mean, that's 2,500 years ago. It would have degraded. It's a plant. Mm. So chemical analysis and found that. And I thought one thing that was interesting is some of the things they have found is a test showed that it was higher in THC than wild varieties. Somewhat, they didn't specifically say that indicated cultivation mm-hmm. of the plant, mm-hmm. although cultivation was a thing that was happening just in general in the world at that time.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't know if it was cultivated or if it was just a higher strain that somebody happened to find, mm-hmm. you know, that was hanging out in the wilderness. But I happen to believe that if they were cultivating things,
right,
why wouldn't they cultivate something they want more of?
Exactly right. If you, make tomatoes and you have a strain of tomatoes that does well and it survives, mm-hmm. you keep that one and you keep going.
Right.
You
know, right.
You have a good weed plant and you keep going.
I'm interested in how they, and there's probably other research out there in similar things, but the object that they actually, I don't know, inhaled this in, because they didn't really smoke it, at least not, they may have smoked it, but they didn't smoke it in this device, because mm-hmm. It's like a wooden container with mm-hmm. somewhat of an oval shaped opening on the top of it, I guess, and rocks inside of it. And they mm-hmm. found the residue on the rocks and on the inside of the chamber. And I guess the theory is the rocks were superheated, which is how they did a lot of stuff mm-hmm. back in the day. They would superheat rocks and bring, you know, you'd superheat rocks and put them in a pot of water to boil the water.
Sure.
Things like that. So I'm wondering how that happened. If the rocks were so hot that it was just, I don't know, kind of cooking it and creating the smoke.
They could have been using like a double boiler type of situation with some water underneath. So you don't have direct heat, and then you've got vapor, and mm-hmm. you're in a cave or somewhere enclosed environment, and you're hotboxing it. I feel like I know – I'm like kind of a way too good of explanations. Maybe I should write articles.
Maybe you should.
This perspective is brought to you.
One cool thing that this did was a lot of times in archaeology we have especially what we would call historic archaeology, which means people were writing stuff down. And historic archaeology in this country has a different, I guess, time period, because it really goes back to the intersection between when Europeans and others first met Native Americans, things mm-hmm. like that. You can still have prehistoric in that time period because Native Americans also acted on their own. But if they interacted with Europeans or anybody who was not Native American, that's usually called ethnohistoric. And then you've got the crossover back into historic. So, but anyway, the Greek philosopher... The Greek historian, I wrote his name down here somewhere, and I'll find it at some point. But, Herodotus, of course, he wrote everything.
Right. It's like, that was the first thing that came up because it's the only one I know.
I know, right? He wrote about people in Central Asia burning cannabis in tents in the 5th century BC. But not everything he wrote about we can just take at face value, because I think he also was known to like make some stuff up and just take some creative license with things. So that was the earliest historical account that we had that mm-hmm. it was happening this far back, but this is one of the first pieces of hard physical evidence that we have that mm-hmm. was happening that far back. So a lot of things in archaeology and history are somewhat theorized based on written accounts, which, like I said, can be subjective. That's why, you know, archaeologists and real scientists, even biblical historians, don't take the Bible at face value, mm-hmm. because the Bible was written in a lot of cases well after the events took place.
What, 500 years
of
supposed events.
Right.
Because if we can't even track our own data that well with the technology and the abilities and the on-purposeness of it that we do, imagine then it's just story told.
Oh, yeah.
It's a game of telephone for 500 years.
Yeah.
And then someone goes, oh, you know what?
Yeah.
I bet I can make a lot of money. And then I'm just going to recount the story.
Right.
The best I know it. And here you go.
There you go. There you go. So, yeah. So that doesn't really work. You know, and we take those writings and we use them as, I don't know, starting points, mm-hmm. I guess, to go start looking things up. Because, for example, finding Troy. Mm-hmm. People, I'm pretty sure we found or think we found where the location of Troy probably was. But the first indications of Troy were written about by historians and people in the era. And they're like, yeah, maybe this did or didn't happen. You know, there wasn't a lot of evidence for it. And then they started looking around based on other writings. You know, this hill kind of matches up with this bay and this thing. And so as they described it, mm-hmm. because the geology didn't change in, you know, a couple thousand years. And then they ended up finding it, and then maybe finding some other artifacts and things associated with that. So, yeah. Anyway, as you said, the burial was found, or the cannabis here was found in conjunction with a burial. And they, of course, suggest participants in the ceremony are using cannabis to communicate with nature or spirits or deceased people. That's stretching it. I mean, it's probably based on ancient Chinese philosophy, you know.
Ancient Chinese secrets?
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Again, anyone that smokes weed with any regularity will tell you that it does not, in fact, allow you to commune with the dead or hallucinate or any of that stuff, which is why I have a hard time thinking that a bunch of Chinese people back in the day did think that.
Right. Well, like, they found this crazy mountain strain, though.
Yeah. I don't know. I've got some thoughts on the ritual deer masks, too.
Yeah. We'll get to ritual deer masks. Yeah. Yeah. I think they also found a good strain of weed.
Yeah. Well, and then, okay, so modern day, or, you know, 500 years from now, 1,000 years from now, people are searching through our archaeology, right?
Right.
My memes are what they find. And then they go into some dude's house that's got a whole room full of taxidermied animals and be like, ooh, look at this church of killing animals and putting them on a wall.
Yeah.
Again, you know, the deerskin mask. How do we know that wasn't just the one weirdo?
Right, right. Well, here's the other thing from the article. So this is the first evidence, physical evidence that we have of burning cannabis, right? Presumably to inhale it, you know, not to, I don't know.
Incense.
Right. Yeah, it wasn't incense, right? I mean, maybe it was. And they were like, well, this incense is
This is the best.
Intense. And, but they have evidence that it was first cultivated in China 3,500 years ago, 1,000 years before this thing was found. Mm-hmm. And they would use it, like a lot of people did around the world, well, at least in areas where it grew, as fiber, oil, and it says food. Mm-hmm. So they're already doing, like, you know, baked goods with cannabis. I mean, edibles, right? Mm-hmm. That's what they call them.
And how many things did the Chinese people invent first?
I think everything.
Like just amazing amounts of stuff, right? You think they did that on their own?
Yeah, yeah, right, right. Nice, nice. They had that creative inspiration.
Right.
Yeah, so
take necessity, add THC, you get new stuff like fireworks.
That's right, that's right. But this is also the difference between science and speculation, and what people say is we have evidence that it was cultivated 3,500 years ago, which probably means well before that. Because if you found evidence of it 3,500 years ago, that wasn't the first time somebody decided to plant it and make a farm.
Right.
And if you have evidence of smoking or inhaling, you know, Bill Clinton style, 2,500 years ago, then it was probably happening well before that. And to be honest, I mean, cultures across the planet, and some cultures still do, they burn their fields after cultivation, right? You know, some of that,
reset the earth,
you know, some of that stuff remains, and somebody was out there in the field when they were burning it going, what is going on right now?
Yeah, you know, that part of the harvest season was everyone's favorite.
Right.
That's where you get feasts.
Yes.
You know, you burn your field and I'm like, oh man, you know what sounds good? Duck.
You're burning that one field, and then the field next to you with all the goats is looking real good right now.
Yeah. Yeah. Happy accident.
Nice. Nice. So anyway, I like to bring stuff up like this because, as we know, as I've said before, there's a difference between speculation and actual evidence. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and people get on archaeologists for that. They say, oh, how do you know, you know, what makes you think that they weren't doing this? It's like, it's not about thinking. It's about actual evidence. Mm-hmm. This is why we dig. This is why we find stuff. This is why we analyze. And then you have to go back and some of the conclusions. I mean, we've been knocking some of the conclusions here as spiritual because we always do that. And I always do that. Mm-hmm. However, you also have to take under consideration what we know of the Chinese people. And as you mentioned, the Chinese have had writing for a really long time. Mm-hmm. So we can go back and look at exactly what they thought about ritual and ceremony, getting real close to that time period. Mm-hmm. You know, so things that they said, you know, there were probably people that did do that, you know, that did do that recreationally, but more than likely, you know, maybe this was a ritualistic kind of thing. Maybe it was like, you know, Hindu cows, you know, there's probably some people that would really like hamburger there, but it's ritualistic not to eat them. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So they don't. I mean, just like uniformly, you can't go to India and get a hamburger. Mm. So, you know, that dominates, and it's possible that in China, this dominated, and people really didn't do it recreationally. I mean, they probably did like it. Or maybe that's why you became a priest.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Totally different reasons now.
Priests were the early Chinese stoners. There you go. Now they're skaters.
Well, so, and that kind of makes sense, candles. Right? Who invented beer?
Monks? Yeah, well.
Maybe? Well, no, well, probably well before, but monks are well known for brewing and...
Monks are well known. Yeah, it was invented well before, and that's actually in one of our news articles if we get to that. So, actually, 11,000 years ago is the first evidence of beer in Turkey. Mm-hmm. No monks there. Yeah. But, and because I don't know that we're actually going to get to this, so I'll mention it now. Beer, it is thought, was accidentally made, just like cheese, from letting stuff sit too long.
Sure.
You know, when they started making bread and other grains and things like that, you had yeast, you had all the ingredients basically for a fermented kind of drink. You get too much water in there, it sits in an environment, and stuff starts to happen to it, and eventually some weirdo is going to go taste it, go, hey, this isn't too bad. Probably someone that just came in from burning the cannabis fields is like, wow, what is that? You know,
again, happy accidents.
I know. It's fizzy. Let's make more.
Yeah.
So anyway, a little more science. The organic material was examined in a laboratory through a chemical analysis known as gas chromatography mass spectrometry, and that's abbreviated GCMS. Basically, they just looked really, really close at it with a microscope, and they created the gases from it, and they were able to tell the exact chemical composition of what this was, including the levels of THC, which is pretty sweet.
And how did they create the gas with these?
They don't speculate on that.
No. I assume it means heating it up one way or another. So, yeah.
Well, that's a good question. You know, I mean, these are just chemical residues, but I mean, then they were probably in a clean room environment when they did this. Sure. But would there be any, you know, anything you could?
I'm assuming it's in a contained.
It would be, but if you were to just burn it, like out on the table, you know, and just light this thing up, would you even? I know you probably wouldn't get any effects from the THC because you're literally THC because you're literally talking about chemical residue. But would you be able to smell this thing that was 2,500 years old and recognize it, I wonder?
And speak to ancient Chinese dead people.
I mean, of course, because the age of the thing you're smelling
right.
speaks to the age of the spirits that you're talking to. Right, that makes total sense. So,
Chris Webster here for the Archaeology Podcast Network. We strive for high-quality interviews and content so you can find information on any topic in archaeology from around the world. One way we do that is by recording interviews with our hosts and guests located in many parts of the world all at once. We do that through the use of Zencastr. That's Z-E-N-C-A-S-T-R. Zencastr allows us to record high-quality audio with no stress on the guest. Just send them a link to click on and that's it. Zencastr does the rest. They even do automatic transcriptions. Check out the link in the show notes for 30% off your first 3 months or go to zencastr.com and use the code TAS. Looking to expand your knowledge of x-rays and imaging in the archaeology field? Then check out An Introduction to Paleoradiography, a short online course offering professional training for archaeologists and affiliated disciplines. Created by archaeologist, radiographer, and lecturer James Elliott, the content of this course is based upon his research and teaching experience in higher education. It is approved by the Chartered Institute for Archaeologists as 4 hours of training. That's in the UK, for those of you that don't know. So don't miss out on this exciting opportunity for professional and personal development. For more information on pricing and course structure, visit paleoimaging.com. That's P-A-L-E-O imaging.com. And look for the link in the show notes to this episode.
Let's move on to the next one. And this one's all about climate change, everybody's favorite topic. And let me find this. So anyway, this article was written by N. Houseman and others for the journal PLOS One, and it's PLOS One. It's Public Library of Science. And it was reported on by grist.org, Aliyah Kabanov, on June 19th, 2019. But basically, what they're talking about is, and they're using one thing as an example right here early on. They say we have 164,000-year-old year history of shellfish consumption on coastal environments. And the reason we know that is because we've seen shell mounds. For some reason, people like to put shells in mounds. I think it's because of the sheer volume of shells, you have to put them somewhere. Unlike other things like the bones of animals and things like that, which you can actually just burn in a fire and it'll eventually, I mean, it's like cremating. Shell doesn't really work that way. You know, it's basically stone. It's calcium, you know. So, or I think that's what limestone becomes, actually. Yeah. I mean, there's a chemical, geological thing happening there. But either way, it doesn't really burn all that well. So they put them in these huge mounds. And, I mean, there's shell mounds, thousands of them, all over the San Francisco Bay Area, a lot of which are now underwater because San Francisco Bay wasn't always underwater. And they're all over coastal environments. So 164,000-year history of shells. And I've got – we'll come back to that number in a second. But the study here is mostly from the – I'll say this wrong – Farrison Islands of the Red Sea, which is about 30 miles offshore from Saudi Arabia. And there's a fluctuating shoreline there, which makes it a great place to study this because I guess it's up, down, up, down. And they can see how it's moving in and out. I mean, the thrust of this whole article is – climate change, as the climate warms, ice caps melt, sea levels rise, we lose archaeological sites. Okay. Now, we're not really talking about what caused the climate change. But the one thing I want to point out is that, yes, we will be losing archaeological sites as sea levels rise. That's obvious. But they're archaeological sites that were created probably within the last 6,000 to 10,000 years, because that's when the last ice age ended.
I was going to say, while we are going to be losing some, we will also be gaining some.
Right.
In the future, right? Well, and as it rises, it's going to get destroyed, but then somewhat preserved. And 500 years from now,
right,
someone will be like, oh, this is when the sea levels rose because they didn't pay attention to climate change.
And we're gaining them in two ways, because that's an incredible point that I was going to actually point out too is, I mean, we have underwater archaeologists right now that are digging up underwater sites. Now, the problem, of course, is the sea doesn't just rise overnight and cover it, right? It rises slowly, and the wave action and things like that will actually damage the site. It'll move things around and things like that. You might have bigger features like pits and stuff like that that are still preserved. Their rough shapes are preserved. But artifacts and things like that will be mostly, at least the ones closer to the surface and the ones subject to erosion, will be moved around and scattered about. So you can't really trust what they're telling you about the site because of that. But you're right. There will be some level of preservation that we're not getting now because it's underwater. Mm-hmm. So there'll be some there. But also, the warming is causing other sites to be found, like the person we interviewed last week from Alaska. I mean, they're digging up there, and they're able to dig in some of the areas they're digging because the permafrost is melting.
Sure.
And people lived there prior to and during the ice age.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, at least up in that area they did. So yeah, climate change is typically thought of as bad, and I wouldn't say it's good necessarily, but it is providing some beneficial effects in being able to find other sites that we wouldn't have in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
However, there are some other effects that people don't think of from climate change, and one of those is increased vegetation growth, because as the Earth warms up, there's higher amounts of vegetation.
Sure.
Yeah, and I know this affected me last year on a very local scale, and I know it wasn't climate, it was more weather, because it was probably just that year. We had a lot of rain last year, the winter of 2017 into 18. We had a lot of snow and then a lot of rain in the spring. And there's this one project that I do up on this mine near Elko, Nevada every year, and they had a couple extra sites they wanted me to try to find and evaluate.
Mm-hmm.
They were recorded like back in the 70s. And I'll tell you what, the vegetation was so high, and it was only like June,
mm-hmm.
so it hadn't even had that long to grow, but the vegetation was so high and so severe, I couldn't find any evidence of these sites. And they were small lithic scatters, we call them, so small chipstone, kind of thing. Not a whole lot left, maybe 10 to 20 or 30 flakes apiece. But when the ground gets dry, mm-hmm. and then B, big sagebrush plants grow in it, it just rips it up and moves it around, mm-hmm. and then these little flakes fall into the cracks, and then they disappear forever until erosion takes place again,
sure.
and you can find them. So yeah, there's a lot of stuff that can affect an archaeological site, and I think really just the best thing we can do right now is we can try to slow down climate change. I mean, we're in a cycle where the Earth is warming, and people are saying, well, is it warming because we caused it to warm, or is it warming because it's warming?
Mm-hmm.
Partly it's warming because it's warming, but the whole anthropogenic climate change argument, which means humans caused it, is kind of a misnomer. Humans aren't necessarily causing it, but we are causing the increase in how quickly it's happening. Because
mm-hmm.
we can go back millions of years in the ice cores and find out how quickly climate change happened. And it's never happened this far. It's never happened this fast in the entire history of climate change that we can see.
Right.
Which is significant.
We're the new variable.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? I mean,
exactly.
Yeah, the Earth is going to go through cycles where eventually there's snowball Earth again and, go through these things. But we're definitely speeding the clock up, I think.
Yeah.
So
we are indeed. One of the sites they mentioned, and we're going to have our favorite word here again, that's probably going to be destroyed if things continue the way they are, is a 30,000-year-old site in Russia. It has carved ivory showing symbolic and, wait for it, ritualistic nature.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
yeah, everything comes down to ritual. Anytime they carved something, it was all ritual. Didn't somebody just sit and carve?
Toothbrush. They ritualistically brush their teeth.
I mean, let's think about life 30,000 years ago in Russia, okay? Mm-hmm. It's cold because it's Russia. I mean, it's probably even June and it's cold, right?
Right.
So it's cold. You're either sitting outside covered in furs by the fire, or you're sitting inside. You've got food. Let's say you're back from the hunt. plenty of game up there that time of year, mm-hmm. you know, so or all times of the year, that time of the world, I should say. So you've got food, you've got other things, the house isn't leaking, you know, everything's fine, kids are happy. What do you do?
Well, yeah, you're moving up Maslow's needs, right? Right. So yeah, eventually start inventing religion or self-actualization yeah. in one way or another if you have all those other things.
Sure. But even if you're carving things in out of ivory and bone and it's and we think it's of a ritualistic nature, I mean, are you constantly just, I don't know, thanking the gods? Are you constantly doing that? I'm not even saying you're not. Maybe no. you are in that time period. Maybe you're just happy to be alive and you need
Maybe
to thank somebody.
Maybe you just like carving on stuff.
Maybe you just like carving on stuff, yeah. I mean, it's a very sort of cathartic activity that people do today when they just want to sit. Anytime you see somebody carving something, I feel like it's 99% of the time in a rocking chair on like a patio. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's done purposely to avoid interaction with other people.
Yes.
Like noisy kids or whatever.
Right.
You're like, oh, I can just scrimshaw on this thing.
Yeah, you can just sit there and carve. So, you know, I hate to be a downer on some of the stuff that archaeologists find, but I do feel like academics who are writing most of these articles, man, they're coming hot off the trails of a bunch of theory classes. Mm-hmm. And they're just like ritual.
I think but, it's, yeah, I just, man, maybe because I haven't been through all that, mm-hmm. I approach the thing as what is the simplest, easiest explanation for human right. behavior? And it's usually not glamorous and it's just like, okay, shell mounds. Why are shells placed in mounds? Or is a mound the natural shape that forms when you just chuck a shell
right.
in a general direction?
Yeah.
Oh, that's the – just throw them over there. When you throw them over there, guess what forms? A mound.
Mound.
Right? So yeah. Is it – ooh, they built – no. It's just, hey, whatever the easiest thing for a person to do, mm-hmm. that's the explanation for why it exists.
Right. You know, it's like it's like geology. You have the law of superposition where things will – things that are older are generally lower, right? Mm-hmm. But you also have the law of that ties with that, and the name is escaping me right now. But it's basically laws in geology and other sciences, other physical sciences that say whatever laws we have now, like the laws of physics and chemistry and geology, mm-hmm. were more than likely true at any point in time in the past. Mm-hmm. So you can generally place those sorts of generalizations and assumptions on things in the past. Mm-hmm. However, nowadays, that's true. I think that's also true, but it's also false in some cases. Where I think it's true is you're right. I mean, people just do stuff because they're bored. People need to practice on stuff, you know, when they're doing stuff like that. And even though they didn't have, you know, PlayStation and Netflix, you know, 30,000 years ago, they still had some chill time. You mm-hmm. know, they still had some relaxation. It wasn't all just hunting and gathering and surviving. I mean, it was a lot of that. Mm-hmm. It was definitely a lot of that. But they definitely had their times, too, where they just lazed around and chatted by the fire, you know, and had nothing to do. I read this book one time called Don't Sleep, There Are Snakes. And it was written by this guy who was a missionary, but after him and his family lived with this typical Amazonian tribe kind of thing for a long time, trying to basically, their goal was to translate their language into English and then translate the Bible back into their language so they could convert them into Christianity. Right. But the guy ended up becoming an atheist and anthropologist.
Right. So. Isn't that seem to be the thing when you start studying too much?
Right.
And you start meeting people and experiencing new cultures and you're like, wow, I'm so limited in my worldview of everything.
That's right. That's right. Well, one of the things he noted with these guys, first off, they had no real natural enemies. Like there were other somewhat uncontacted tribes out there that were just living like they lived for thousands of years, mm-hmm. but they were so far away it was almost no factor. So these guys weren't really warring that much. They weren't doing anything. They would go out and cook, and they had no schedule either. If somebody came back with food in the evening, there's no way to preserve it in the jungle. Mm-hmm. You got to cook that and eat it mm-hmm. now. Mm-hmm. And so they would eat until they were engorged until 4 a.m. and then sleep until they woke up and do it all over again. And they had a lot of chill time to just sit down and do nothing, mm-hmm. you know, and they literally would do nothing. I mean, the women are doing things to process stuff for clothing and things like that, you know, made out of like grass and stuff. Mm-hmm. And because it's the jungle and, you know, the men are doing stuff as well. But for the most part, there was a lot of time to just sit and relax mm-hmm. and not do stuff. And I know that amount of time varies across the planet and across time. But I think every society, every person, every family that's ever lived has had at least some amount of time where you're just sitting there going, yeah, what am I going to do right now? Mm-hmm. You know, everything's done. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Maybe
tell a story.
I know. Maybe it's when you get older and the younger people in the tribe are doing that. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. So anyway, one quick thing on climate change before we leave. I thought this was an interesting stat, statistic. 200,000 sites approximately from Louisiana to Maryland on the coasts are in danger of being destroyed by sea level rise. I know, right? And it says of only 3 feet, but 3 feet is a pretty significant sea level rise.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I've heard people concerned of 6 inches.
Yeah, totally.
3 feet?
3 feet's a lot.
I mean, I don't know the stat. What was Katrina? What did that do to New Orleans?
Yeah. And that swell was a lot more than 3 feet right
was
there.
It?
Yeah. Yeah. But that's a one-off kind of thing.
Right.
But I mean, I think at 3 feet, you lose almost all of Florida. Yeah. Which is that a loss?
Right. And then when you do, and all the houses get flooded and preserved.
Right.
Right. And then some archaeologist from 1,000 years comes back and goes, man, look at all these guns in the water. Yeah. This is the ritual when they would throw all their weapons into the ocean as a ceremony to Poseidon.
Ceremony to Poseidon. Nice. Nice. Like,
nah, man, they had to evacuate.
Oh, man. See, now I want to make archaeology, because you know they said Washington D.C. is under threat too, because the Potomac is tied so closely to the Atlantic, and the levels will rise there. I think they mentioned the Lincoln and Washington Memorial, but I want to go throw a bunch of Cheeto bags in the river, so people in the future can be like, they'll see the reference to Trump as, you know, looking like a Cheeto, and then let's say that was ritualistic in nature to throw Cheetos and Cheeto bags in the water.
It's what helped him get reelected.
Yes, that's right. That's right. That's what I want to do. All right. So, one more time here as we take a short break from talking about the news. And we're not even going to get to all the things that I wanted to talk about, which is great. Leaves us more stuff for later. But I want to remind you, if you do want to call in, 775-515-4141. Again, this is a call-in show, so call in anytime you want about anything, 775-515-4141. Okay, so now we're going to bring up an article from the San Diego Union-Tribune, written by Ernie Cohen on June 22nd, 2019. And I'm bringing this up because I think I've talked about this on literally every single show that I've recorded over here, but it's basically, it's a column, and it's called Best to Notify Experts of Archaeological Finds. I wouldn't say it's the best titled column, but, you know, there we go. Anyway, this person named Cindy Stankowski was interviewed by Ernie Cowan, and she is the executive director of the San Diego Archaeological Center. And she says that, I thought she had some really good kind of one-liners in here to talk about why you should notify experts if you find something. She said that keeping a random arrowhead or piece of pottery left behind by early Indians is like ripping the pages from a book of history, and the pages are yet to be read. And that's what she says. And that's a really good way to look at it. Is if you find something and you pick it up, you've already kind of destroyed history a little bit. Mm-hmm. If you wiggled it out of the ground, that's especially bad, right? Mm-hmm. But the thing is, if you do pick something up, because you're going to, because maybe you don't know what it is and you're going to pick something up and it's going to be weird, try to put it back down in the same way that you found it. I know that's probably unlikely. If you're in like a trail or something like that, I mean, you gotta kind of play it by ear there, you know, if something is found in that way. But the best way to handle things is to take a picture of it. If you can, take a point. If you take a picture with your phone, chances are the metadata will contain a GPS point. And then you can send that to a park ranger if you're in a park, or BLM office or something like that, and just let them know. Say, hey, I found this thing. I left it over there. People think they're doing good by picking it up and bringing it to them, but rangers and archaeologists would rather you just left it, you know. Again, if it's in a high traffic area somehow and has never been seen before, which is highly unlikely.
Right.
But if it's in a high traffic area, then you got to kind of make a call on that, you know. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because if you leave it, who's to say the next person didn't just take it?
And they probably will. I think statistically, nearly every human that sees that will pick it up if they're not an archaeologist or a park ranger, you know, or BLM archaeologist or something like that. So, yeah, you know, I just wanted to bring this up because people are writing about it, and it's important. Again, she says take pics and a GPS point. And you might think that I talk about cultural resource management a lot here, which is basically archaeology in advance of construction and other federally mandated and state mandated things. If you're in California, the California Environmental Quality Act dictates a lot of what is done there culturally. when people are out doing stuff, like putting up solar farms and things like that. So you might think that a lot of these questions get answered during those processes. So if you find something when you're out just walking in the desert doing mm-hmm. something, that it's not really going to matter in the grand scheme of things. But the problem is, you know, a lot of things like two things that we use relatively heavily in analysis, especially in desert environments because it preserves well, is pollen analysis. Mm-hmm. You can see the little, you know, pollen's not that small, actually. When you look at it under a microscope, it's not that small. And every bit of pollen from different plants and trees looks different. So you can say, oh, I see this pollen. It's got these spiky little things on it. That's from a juniper tree, mm-hmm. you know, or that's from a sagebrush or it's from rabbit brush or something like that. So you can tell what people are eating if you find this pollen in context with other archaeological artifacts on a site, things like that. There might be residue on something or something like that. So it's called pollenology or palynology when you find this stuff. The other one is protein analysis, which is also pretty cool. And that's probably really similar to the cannabis story in how they analyze that residue, although there's different ways to analyze the residue. But basically, arrowheads and projectile points, when you pick those things up, and I've done this and I've seen people do this, especially if they're buried, you might want to like spit on it or put water on it to clean it up, you know, or something like that. But you're actually destroying some of the residues that could be on it. And when when those things go through an animal and they hit the bone and the blood and things like that, it'll dry on there and stay for thousands of years, which is pretty amazing. But it'll stay for thousands of years. And we can do a residue analysis, a protein analysis on that and look at the DNA and find out, you know, what kind of animal did this go through. Mm-hmm. So that's pretty cool. I'm sure I've asked you this before. Have you ever found anything out anywhere that you thought might be an archaeology, like an artifact or something like that?
You know,
just somewhere.
Back in junior high, we went on a science field trip to the bluffs right by the ocean. I'm from Southern California.
Mm-hmm.
And me being silly or whatever, I told my teacher that I found like a mortar and pestle type deal, because there was kind of a roundish shape deal and a rock that looked like it would be good, and I wanted extra credit. So I don't know. I may have just found something that looked very similar. I've never found like a point, or not knowingly.
Mm-hmm. Well, mortar and pestle type stuff is really common.
Mm.
So it wouldn't be shocking to know think that you had found something like that.
Mm. We had the Chumash Indians right there and all that. So it could have been. It could have been me just projecting. But mm-hmm. other than that, I've never found anything very specifically like, ooh, look at this. This is mm-hmm. a point. This is pottery. No, I've never seen anything like
that. Right. Yeah. Well, I don't think it's incredibly common, because most people are on established hiking trails and things like that, where unless there's a ton of erosion, and even then, I mean, you're probably in areas where, you know, maybe they were old Native American trails that are now hiking trails, mm-hmm. which is totally possible. Now, a lot of old Native American pathways and trails are highways now, mm-hmm. because they're common, easy ways to get through places.
Sure.
And they're humans, so they're going to do it that way.
Especially in Southern California. That's the path they took to form the missions
mm-hmm.
all the way up and down the coast. So
yeah. Also, when I was working down in Southern California in Arizona a couple months ago, Interstate 8, I think. Is that the one that goes along the border out of San Diego? I think it's 8. Anyway, Interstate 8 is basically follows Native American trail system, which became a highway, which became Route 66 in a lot of that area. It went right through Yuma and then became Interstate 8. So, you know, if it's the easiest way to get through the hills, we're all going to find it.
Exactly why I say, whenever we're looking for an explanation of why people did something, look for the easiest thing.
Yeah. Occam's razor.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, one thing that she noted in this article, especially about San Diego, but this is, I mean, true to a varying extent everywhere, is that she says in San Diego, there have been three very distinct cultures with large gaps in between in the last 12 to 14,000 years.
Hmm.
And climate change could be the cause, she said. As climate fluctuates, people could be pushed out of areas and then come back in. But it could also just be that, you know, we don't have the data yet for some of those areas. Mm-hmm. You know, we can't assume the lack of evidence is the answer for something like that. You know, the lack of evidence could just mean we haven't found it yet.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I think that's the same, obviously, everywhere on the planet. I mean, we don't have a year-by-year history of what happened in every location, so because we haven't found the evidence for every single year, and we're never going to, which means our job will never end. Everything we find just adds more pages to that book, you know, and if the more the more pages that are ripped out, the more we have to find to try to replace those and then go from there and fill in the blanks. Mm-hmm. So another thing she mentioned is the need for a statewide database so people can analyze these things. Now, one thing she may not be aware of, she mentions a statewide database, but I really hate it when people talk like that because as an archaeologist who's worked all over the country, I would like to see a national database, mm-hmm. Because Native Americans didn't know state boundaries.
Right.
Now, California is a little different because the mountains, which form a lot of the border for California, were a boundary.
Sure.
They were a geographical boundary that many people just didn't cross on a regular basis, right? So California, in that respect, is kind of unique because of those boundaries. But those boundaries don't exist everywhere. Mm-hmm. They do mostly. There's parts of California on the other side of the mountains too. But it's one thing that I've interviewed these people before on the Archaeology Podcast Network, but there's a thing called DINA, the Digital Index of North American The Digital Index of North American something or other. North American Archaeology, I think. Mm. DINAA. Mm. Anyway, they started in the Southeast, and they're basically taking the records from state historic preservation offices and bringing them all into a single centralized database that you can search terms and find all these things, right? And if you're not an archaeologist, you can search and you'll see like at the county level or some other big level where something is. Mm-hmm. But if you have credentials in that state, you can see a finer point on where those things are and then further records about them, So that's pretty cool. And as that marches across the country, I think that's going to end up being really the answer. Mm-hmm. And then we also interviewed Kristen Hazard, founder of WildNote, a company and full disclosure that I'm currently wearing the hat for and literally wearing the hat right now and that I work for. But, collecting data that can be entered easily into a database is also important. So having companies and academics and other people collect data in a digital way, just because there's no money, as we mentioned before, when we were talking about CRM earlier, doing those analyses, they don't do them because there's no money in the budget to do that. Mm-hmm. But if they could save money by not having to digitize all their data into a database from paper, which is what they do now, then there might be that extra money to do the extra analyses. Mm-hmm. So who knows? And I'm not saying they have to use WildNote, but WildNote is one way that could be done for sure, because that's how we've designed it. So,
well, I think we've mentioned before that in conversations not on the air,
yeah.
That the point is that most people that are not archaeologists, they don't care mm-hmm. about destroying, or they don't know, they don't recognize the importance of sure. CRM. And people would need to be incentivized to not disturb the site.
Right.
So it would be neat if there was some way, like I think we spoke about before, some kind of social media app where you do get some sort of reward or you do get some sort of incentive by clicking that picture, submitting it to the database, and it gets registered and added to the whole thing. Mm-hmm. Of course, I don't know how you fund all that because now you've got money to pay them and money to pay you for your own stuff. But I just think, you would have to incentivize people against what you don't want them to do.
Yeah. Along those lines, and I wasn't intending to bring this up, but you made me think about it. I interviewed somebody for the archaeology show yesterday, and I don't even know when this episode is going to be out. It's going to be like September sometime. But he's actually a high-energy physicist from Finland. Mm-hmm. But I came into contact with him because I met somebody else who was working up there studying the sounds that whales make and how those sounds are recognized in rock art from Russia, Finland, Norway, because there was a lot of white whale hunting up there and they would use it for meat and oil and things mm-hmm. like that, of course. And apparently, and there's a lot of rock art up there too. And rock art in the form of not just rock carvings or petroglyphs, as we call them, but pictographs. And in fact, mm-hmm. he said in Finland and I think Sweden, there are no carvings on rocks that anyone has ever discovered. But there are tens of thousands of pictographs painting with red ochre almost exclusively, which is another really interesting kind of side note. But anyway, we interviewed this guy and we talked about the intersection of rock art and whales in one of the segments. And one of the things he mentioned from a conservation standpoint is, first off, whales are still being hunted up there. In fact, they're being hunted less and less, but they're still being hunted. And he said his approach to reducing the hunting of whales was to reduce their value.
Mm-hmm.
So reduce the hunting value of whales. So if you take the value away and you put money into whales in some other way where some people can still make money off of them, then hunting will reduce. And I thought that was just genius. And the way he did that was he's established from Portugal up through Russia, basically whale watching tours.
Mm-hmm.
And they're making tons of money doing whale watching tours. And because the whale watching tours are making more money than the hunting of whales and the selling of the oil, it's preserving the whales.
Right.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, we don't get anywhere by telling people you can't do something.
Yeah.
Right? You have to create something that's more fun or more enjoyable than the current thing that they enjoy doing.
Indeed.
I just thought the same thing. If you found a way to make reducing carbon emissions profitable, people would do it.
Oh, yeah.
Right. They only don't do it because it doesn't make them money.
Doesn't make them money.
But the second you can find a way to actually reduce it and make money, everyone will be on board.
And therein lies the problem for archaeology, is if we want to preserve things that you find on the ground, where's the monetary incentive to leaving it there?
Right.
And I keep thinking, is it like a video game or something that has sponsors where you could actually pay people if they upload pictures or something?
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. Like you earn points and you sell ads and then you use that to pay the people. And
it might just be advertisers that make money because people will do anything that's gamified.
Mm.
You know, if you gamify it, I mean, have you heard about the new Harry Potter game that came out?
I have not.
It's basic. I think it's called Wizards Unite because I heard about it. It's all over my social media, but
says something.
I know, right? But it's made by the same people who did Pokemon Go,
which also says something.
I know. And it's actually incredibly similar to Pokemon Go.
Mm-hmm.
Like a lot of the things in the game people are saying are like a direct parallel to that game.
They just put a different skin over the mechanics.
I mean, essentially, right?
Yeah.
You know, some different music, some different graphics, and you're done.
Mm-hmm.
But the point is, people are eating it up all over the world. You know, this thing debuted like less than a week ago, and people are eating it up all over the world. So my point is, if you could create a system like that where people use augmented reality to interact with the world, and you almost encourage them to find sites, almost encourage them to find things out in the real world. And unlike these games where the app knows where things are because it's generating them, we don't know where the things are.
Yeah, it's user created content.
Exactly. And I'm just really formulating this idea as we're speaking about it because I hadn't thought about it before. But I've thought about having an app where people could submit everything, but what's the incentive?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then who's going to manage that? But if you have an app that people are more than happy to download and open up every time they're out doing something or hiking or whatever.
Mm.
You could even use this because discovering new archaeological things is really hard. I mean, I've been on projects where I'm purposely trying to do that for months and haven't seen anything, right? I mean, it's just really hard in some areas. So you could also use it as a conservation tool because conditional assessments are also really expensive to do, to send people out and say, well, you know, we had a bunch of snow and rain this summer. What is that old mining town doing?
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's no funding to send a ranger out to every single mining town in Nevada and check that out.
Mm-hmm.
And even then, do they know what they're looking for? You know, are they bringing the records out with them and comparing everything? No, probably not.
Mm-hmm.
But plenty of people are taking pictures when they go to these places. So if you take pictures within this application, creates a little photo album for you, uploads to Instagram, does all these things, you just gamify it and understand that people are going to do that. Well, then now we have this whole database of condition assessments that we've created. And then we can do like somebody created a 3D model. There were already plenty of them, but somebody created a 3D model of Notre Dame after it burned down from just tourist pictures because there's enough of them in enough angles. Now, admittedly, there's like, you know, 80% of them are from the same angle, you know, facing the front of the building.
Sure.
But there's plenty of them from all over the place that they could just make a model. So I think gamifying this thing and not siloing it just for archaeologists and saying, don't go there, don't do anything.
Mm.
You know, if we've already recorded it once and we have a baseline of information, we should almost look at it as, listen, we're lucky to have that and let's take anything else we can get, you know, and we know the public is going to go there. We know they're going to take pictures. Let's incentivize them to take pictures of them in their current condition and then reward them for that, you know, in some way. I don't know what that looks like.
I don't know. The only problem I think, and I'm just thinking of it now, is you may have seen, I think it was maybe a couple months ago, where you say you have these influencers, right, on Instagram or whatever, and they go, oh, the California poppies are blooming.
Yeah.
And then 6 trillion people visit the site and destroy it, right?
Yeah.
And there's no poppies left. Now, archaeology is quite a bit more niche than just, mm-hmm. you know, California poppies. But I wonder if you would have that problem. If you, you know, you mark it and you geotag it and then six people run up there, and do they end up destroying the site by visiting it because we've made it popular?
Right. Right. Yeah, and that's a good question to ask.
To consider, you know, like we made it popular, now we've destroyed it because you can't trust people. This is why we can't have nice things.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, you got to wonder about that. And then you have the other implications, like Native American concerns. I mean, typically your more active Native American tribes don't want anybody near the sites for any reason whatsoever,
sure.
let alone archaeologists, mm-hmm. you know, which I understand, you know, they're ancestral, ceremonial, you know, ritualistic, not all the time. But they are, you know, in reality, they are like that. So, yeah, it's a sticky situation and a tough problem to solve.
Sure.
So, the last thing she says in this article is there's no monetary value to these things. Exciting to find, but no real value. No real value is in what we can discover from studying them in context. What she means by that is there's no value to them monetarily, but there's a high value in context studying. If you just brought me a projectile point, I might mm-hmm. be able to tell you something about it, but I can tell you more about it if I can see what setting it's in, what other things are around it.
Sure.
You know, where was this located? Was this located at 9,000 feet up on a mountain? Very big deal versus being found next to a river down in a valley.
Mm-hmm.
That says a lot about the people and the time frame is what we're talking about here. Not only the shape and things like that. So,
well, and I think the article is probably very true about projectile points, but I think ISIS might beg to differ about all historical things not having monetary value.
Yes. Right?
Billions of dollars of monetary value.
Yeah, probably. So,
you may have heard my pitch for membership. It's a great idea and really helps out. However, you can also support us by picking up a fun t-shirt, sticker, or something from a large selection of items from our Tee Public store. Head over to arcpodnet.com/shop for a link. That's arcpodnet.com/shop to pick up some fun swag and support the show.
Anyway, we are coming near the end here, but I want to go over this one last article real quick, and just because it's got some kind of neat things in it, and we're not going to be able to talk about all of them, but the article is called Back to the Stone Age, 17 Key Milestones in Paleolithic Life, and it's written by Tom Metcalf, who is a contributor to Live Science, written on June 24th. But basically, it's like 17 things that somewhat define Paleolithic life, and when we say Paleolithic, I mean, there's the middle, upper Paleolithic, the Neolithic, the Stone Age. I mean, all this is Paleolithic, and it dates back to, around 500,000 years ago, give or take, but it's a long time. But one of the things is hand axes. You might have heard about the Acheulean hand axe, which is spelled A-C-H-E-U-L-E-A-N, but it's pronounced Acheulean because it was it was found in France. But these are axes like the size of your hand.
Mm-hmm.
But they've been found all over the place, dating back up to 1.75 million years ago. So a common stone tool.
So are these like just palm held as like no actual?
Yeah. They're not hafted.
Thank you.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, and then you see knives like that now, mm-hmm. actually with the curved blade.
Yeah.
And it's just, I mean, it looks like you could chop on something. Or,
yeah, totally. Yeah. The hand axes were actually somewhat bigger than your hand in some cases. And they literally would grab two hands on it and just pound and chop and chop wood and cut skin and meat and, you know, different things. They're always made out of harder rocks. So there's a lot of skill in actually making those, too. I'm going to run through a couple of these real quick as we're running out of time here. Cave dwellings, spears, a lot of the stuff we know of as early human activity was developed during this several hundred thousand year time span between what was Homo erectus leading into Homo sapiens, Neanderthals, and Neanderthal, not Neanderthal. We can have that discussion later.
No, I read that article.
Yeah. And all that. You may have heard of Venus figurines. Those were found. Those are, you know, women that look like they're pregnant. They have, you know, big thighs, big stomach, thought to represent a goddess figure named for the Greek goddess Venus. Greek or Roman?
Roman.
Roman. Yeah. Yes, Roman. I always get those mixed up.
Aphrodite, right?
Oh, yeah. I think you're something like that. Yeah. I don't know. We're getting out of my wheelhouse now. Anyway, 25 to 28,000 years ago for that. Cave art developed during this time, making music. The oldest instrument is a bone flute made out of an ancient vulture bone. Dates to 40,000 to 43,000 years ago. Bone and antler carvings, specialized spears. Now, the deer mask, they said ritual or hunting on this one. They found a deer mask that dated to 22 to 8,000 years ago, found in northern England. It could have been ritual or a hunting disguise, mm-hmm. or somebody who just had too much THC.
So they found how many?
Well, they're just mentioning the one here, but I don't know. There's probably lots of them out there. I don't know.
I was going to say, now that might give us a clue. If they found one, that's a weirdo, right? If you find 30 of 40, 1,000, okay, fine. Everyone was doing it. You find one, that was the dude that lived on the outskirts of the village.
Yes. Yeah, just wearing the deer skull.
Yeah, he never took it off.
No. He slept with that on.
He became the priest of the village.
That's right. Sunken islands, I thought was an interesting one because climate change was a huge factor for hundreds of thousands of years, you know, with ice sheets coming and going.
Look at Atlantis.
That's a whole other topic. Cannibals, farming, cheese and beer. The oldest known cheese is 9,000 years old. Again, that means it's even older because that's just what we have evidence of. The oldest beer, 11,000 years old in Turkey. They said Neolithic fashion. I mean, everything from domestication and using the skins. Utzi, the Iceman you may have heard of from the Austrian Alps, dated to 5,300 years ago. Not only did he have tattoos, but he was from not even in that area, but he had skins of domesticated and wild sheep and goats, and they were treated and sewn together. Family burials, not just individual burials, but family burials, you know, just an emphasis on doing these kinds of things. So anyway, abstract art and standing stones. If you've seen Outlander or Stonehenge, you know what standing stones are. So. Mm-hmm. Anyway, we've got just a few seconds left. I want to remind you, this is Chris Webster and Brian Woods.
Thank you very much.
And this has been The Archaeology Show. We'll see you next time. I'll be back in 3 weeks, but we've got two great shows coming up shortly in the next 2 weeks. I didn't say that well, but here they are.
Thanks for listening to the Archaeology Podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. You can provide feedback using the contact button on the right side of the website at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/archaeology. Or you can email Chris at archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Please like and share the show wherever you saw it so more people can have a chance to listen and learn. Send us show suggestions and follow ArcPodNet on Twitter and Instagram. This show is produced by the Archaeology Podcast Network. Opinions are solely those of the hosts and guests of the show. However, the APN stands by their hosts. Special thanks to the band Sea Hero for letting us use their song, I Wish You'd Look. Check out their albums on Bandcamp at seahero.bandcamp.com. Check out our next episode in 2 weeks. And in the meantime, keep learning, keep discovering new things, and keep listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network. Have an awesome day. This show is produced and recorded by the Archaeology Podcast Network, Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle in Reno, Nevada at the Reno Collective.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Thanks again for listening to this episode and for supporting the Archaeology Podcast Network. If you want these shows to keep going, consider becoming a member for just $7.99 US a month. That's cheaper than a venti quad eggnog latte. Go to archpodnet.com/members for more info.